Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up on today's show...
We work in this material clay, which has thousands of years of history, and we work within the traditional processes and skills, but we can do many more things than what people expect.
Anthony Quinn there, the head of the ceramics design course at Central St Martin's School here in London. He showed us around an exhibition of some of the best ceramics work that's been done by teachers and students that have passed through the institution's doors. Next up...
I think we have to get these traditional techniques, but with creativity, and not just make easy objects to sell to tourists.
We head to Portugal to check out the atelier of a rug company combining traditional manufacturing techniques with a contemporary aesthetic. And finally, Australian photographer Paul Barbera tells us about documenting creative workspaces in Japan. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Now, most people will have some kind of ceramic design object in their home. But as design disciplines go, there's no denying that ceramics suffers from a lack of sex appeal. Now, Central St Martin's Art School in London is hosting an exhibition trying to change that. The school is one of only two universities in the UK with a specialist ceramics course, and it's the only one with an emphasis on design. Anthony Quinn is the head of the course. He gave me a tour of the exhibition.
The course began somewhere approximately 104 years ago. It started off as a series of evening class type courses. The original one was called China Painting for Ladies. And then somewhere around 1918, a woman called Dora Billington started the first formal curriculum. And she was a really influential person. She set herself up sort of in opposition to Bernard Leach and those sort of people of the day. She called Bernard Leach a dilettante because he was very much just about the making. And
who was Bernard Leach?
Well, Bernard Leach is considered one of the sort of fathers of the British ceramic craft movement. It was him and a guy called Shoji Hamada. And they were very much about like the sort of authenticity of the throne form. And they coined the phrase, the fortuitous blemish. So they were important people. But Dora Billington saw that as very much just a particular paradigm, and it wasn't open to all these other possibilities in working with the material. So she coined this phrase, craftsmanship alone is not enough, setting herself up in opposition to those guys. And we've sort of post-rationalised, if you like, that this phrase very much captures the DNA of the approach historically for the last 100 years.
Should we have a look at some of the stuff that you've got on display?
Yeah, should we start with Gordon? Gordon Baldwin is a really key person very much in the area of studio ceramics. He graduated from Central School in 1952. And this picture up here is his degree show. In this work, you can see very much the sort of ways he's beginning to work that become very influential on other makers. We're very lucky to have this piece that's actually in the photograph. So my colleague went and visited him in Staffordshire and was given, they went through his attic and found, you know, these old pieces. But he's considered a really important maker. He sort of broke with formality, very much moving away from this sort of Leach thing of the orthodoxy of the throne form, and got into more sculptural and mark making and very expressive surfaces.
So one thing that I'm interested in looking at these is that the one from the beginning of his career is a more conventionally shaped glazed bowl. I mean, it's very beautiful, but I can kind of imagine it in my nan's house. Yeah. And then at the end of his career, he's moved on to a much more abstract, unglazed and kind of distorted form. How does his career and his work fit into the wider discipline of design? Was he a fine artist? Was he an object or product designer? How can he be categorized, if at all?
He would be much more of an artist working through the medium of ceramics. Starts his career in the sort of conventional sort of craft arena and very quickly moves into more of a sculptural approach, which challenges these orthodoxies around craftsmanship and stuff. So he would now be considered a sculptural ceramicist or artist, if you like. Clay is a really difficult material to work with, and it takes a long time to master it. So I always talk about the fact that our students, it takes them 3 years to make good work, you know, and we need a degree for that reason. A lot of people think they can come into the ceramic studio and in a couple of weeks make something of a high degree of finish, and it's just not possible. And so the interesting thing about the more traditional bowl-like form moving to the sculptural form, this spans 50 years of his career. And over time, his work has become more and more sculptural and challenging to those sort of perceived notions of what a ceramic object should look like.
Let's talk about these flower pots.
So this is the work of Patrick Morris. He's a graduate from about 8 years ago. He took that design approach, which was to ask us a challenging question. So he just looked at the idea. He noticed that a lot of plants in the wild grow upside down, that we have this convention of the plant pot sat on the surface and then it grows, you know, vertically. And he just asked this question, what happens if I try and sort of mirror the way that these plants are growing in reality? So he turned the plant pot upside down, and what happens is the water drains out first, you end up with a puddle on the floor, then the soil dries and the whole thing falls out of the pot. So he had to come up with a series of solutions, the first one being he needed this collar to hold the soil in place. But the most interesting one, inside this pot, there's a low-fired terracotta red clay pot in there, a reservoir which you pour water into. The roots of the plant are drawn to the moisture, so they grow towards the moisture very quickly. And then the water is sucked through the clay by the plant. So it doesn't leach through the clay into the soil. It's sucked through the clay by the plant's sort of lo-fi capillary action, if you like. So it's a really playful bit of science here. And this is a really interesting product. That's sort of, a lot of our students sort of challenge the perceived orthodoxy of the material ceramics and what it can do. The course is called Ceramic Design, and people often think that means we make work for production. We make very little work for production, but we make a lot of work that sort of challenges that idea and explores the quality of the material and what you can do with it, but also what you don't expect to do with it. This was actually on the film Prometheus in the spaceship. You know, I think it's a prequel to Alien. So this is such a futuristic object that was sort of featured heavily in this film. In this as a background, there's a prop of these upside down hanging plants in this spaceship. So
I like the idea of a kind of very ancient material colliding with a kind of futuristic setting. Should we go on, because the listeners will have been able to hear that smashing sound of Jason Lim's piece. Should we have a chat about that? Should we go this way? So this is a piece called Just Dharma, and Jason Lim submitted it. Was it representing Singapore?
Yeah.
For the Venice Biennale in 2007. Tell me about this piece and its relationship to Central St. Martin's and the course.
Well, the interesting what the exhibition is, we've been a bit broad. So he graduated from the course. It's not work he did on the course, but it's sort of inspired by the ethos of the course, which is this sort of challenging approach to the idea of craftsmanship. So Jason, some years after graduation, was invited to represent Singapore in Venice. And he made this huge chandelier of these handmade pieces, and it sort of vibrates and glows, and it's in this sort of darkened room, this chamber, if you like. People are drawn to this installation and they're just, in a way, admiring the beauty of it. But what they don't know, which there's this sort of transgressive act, at some point, 3 or 4 minutes into the performance, he cuts the cord, and the chandelier, which must be about 7 or 8 meters long, crashes to the floor, and there's this cacophony of sort of crashing that they heard.
Did they know it was going to happen?
As far as I'm aware, I didn't see this live, but no one knew he was going to do this. So there's this, like, what I like about it, it's a one-shot sort of performance, because the rest of the exhibition is the piece strewn all over the floor, you know, in bits. So I like the sort of unforgiving nature of it, you know. It's a very powerful piece.
Can we also have a look at the toilet before I ask you some more questions?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it's important to illustrate the scope of different objects that you have on display here, from fine art to this toilet by Robin Levien, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Levien. So Robin Levien graduated from the course in the 70s, and he has a design studio in South London, and he works both in tableware and in sanitaryware. He describes it as he designs for both ends of the alimentary canal. This has got a number of innovations, this toilet, the way it's been manufactured. It doesn't have this overhang where lots of germs capture and stuff. But then we put it on a plinth because it's 100 years of Duchamp's fountain. So when Robin brought the toilet in, we first put it on the plinth, and then we got this huge sort of Perspex vitrine, which we put the toilet in the vitrine. So now we have the most ubiquitous production object in the room. If you like, the least valuable object in the most valuable sort of setting. So it's the only piece under glass. So just a bit of playful sort of positioning, if you like.
That gives you an idea of the scope of the object you've got here. It's only a tiny selection. There's also like a picnic ware set. You've got an auction of plates called China Painting for Ladies, referencing the original title of the course. What, if anything, connects all of the objects in this room?
the connection, the DNA in the room is this idea of challenging the sort of perceived nature of what a ceramics course would deliver. One of my favorite pieces of recent years is the world map. There's a world map made of these small 2-3 centimeter tall black basalt pots, which were painstakingly thrown by a woman called Monica Granville. When people first see it, the map appears incomplete. But actually, when they sort of read this as the explanation of it, it's actually an infographic. It's a map that shows the daily rate of maternal mortality at birth. So it's an infographic that shows this is many mothers die giving birth daily. And so consequently, there's no Scandinavia on the map, because we don't have a daily rate for Northern Europe. It happens, but not in the way it does in Northern Africa and various other places in India. And they've got a huge rate of daily deaths given birth. So this is a really powerful, emotional, direct sort of challenge to the viewer. And for me, that and a number of objects sort of capture that idea of what the course sort of, what we believe the course stands for, which is, okay, we work in this material clay, which has thousands of years of history, and we work within the traditional processes and skills, but we can do many more things than what people expect.
Anthony Quinn there, the head of the ceramics course at Central St Martin's in London. The exhibition, Craftsmanship Alone is Not Enough, runs in the school's Letherby Gallery until the 11th of February. Next week, Monocle magazine celebrates its 10th anniversary with its 101st issue. It includes a Portugal survey looking at some of the freshest people, places and ideas in the Iberian nation. Now, much has been made about the comeback of Portugal's textile factories, but a lot of the revived industry is being applied to producing generic, regional products to meet the demands of tourists. However, the Atelier of Gur, a rug factory in the country's north, does things differently. Sima Tarek reports.
Inside a small workshop in the northern Portuguese city of Viana do Castelo, Claudia is making a rug on a traditional flat-weaving hand loom. She is faithfully working on intricate patterns designed by Porto-based artist Maria Fernandes. It is one of the ongoing collaborations that define Gur, a rug brand started by designer and former print technician Celio Esteves. She and Claudia have become experts in making a humble product, made from 100% cotton rag and finished with simple sewing, into fun, contemporary pieces that can be used in the kitchen, for a picnic, and more often than not, hung up as a wall piece. In this unpretentious ex-garage, 30 Gur rugs are produced a week.
Since a long time, and since I was a child here in Vienna, we always had this big relation with working with your hands and producing things by hands. And I used to do it a lot when I was younger. I learned to broidery alone. So my mother also had a hand loom at home. So I have this very close relationship to the techniques and materials and to do things with my hands. So that's one of the things that I really like about Gur, is that I can work and produce things instead of being on the computer the whole day and like working as a designer, that I wasn't happy.
At her old job at Porto's Fine Arts University, Celia would help artists find solutions to print their work. Now, she offers them the chance to be showcased on an item seen in nearly every Portuguese kitchen. The designs, however, have that extra touch. From playful figures and quirky geometric shapes, to even abstracted notions of what a rug is, with fringe sewn into the centre, for example. It all began when Celia and Claudia worked together for an exhibition that paired up artisans and designers in Viana a few years ago. Now their work depends on a cast of young artistic and design talent, many of whom hail from Porto, a city bursting with illustrators, designers and the like, but not many of whom are used to working in such a traditional format.
Every time I start working with an artist, I send him a briefing with a lot of examples from rugs that were already made. So the better way is that you can see what is possible and not possible to do. But even though after that, I still have to send a lot of designs back, and sometimes I cut pieces of the design and I tell them this could be possible, but try to make it more elaborate, but not that much. So it's always a sharing of emails for, could be for 1 month to 2 or 3 months till we finally get a design that is possible for the handloom.
Though much is made about made in Portugal these days, handicrafts are at risk thanks to stable but low-paid factory work in the region, which has also meant the rise in standardised products. But weaver Claudia, who also has input into the design process, is happy here. She taught Celia all she needed to know about the weaving process, and as somebody who started working at the town's factory at 15, she knows a lot.
São trabalhos diferentes, mas o rigor é desafiante porque são peças diferentes e depois a gente pode explorar mais técnicas.
It's a very different work now, but it's challenging work because there are always different pieces and we can explore different techniques compared to the factory work. The other rugs I did there, we worked with techniques such as puxadinhos, bars, interlacing, doing drawings, and now it's more challenging because we have the opportunity to explore more. The work I did before, although it was more traditional, it was still adapted to modern times because it was with other colors, other patterns, it wasn't as traditional as the others. And well, even though I could change the patterns, the technique was always the same. But now we can do many different things.
Nós vamos inventando nomes. We made up names for techniques that because we didn't use before. Even Claudia didn't use them before.
But I like very much the work I'm doing here, same as before. If I didn't like it, I would have changed it. I have been doing this for a very long time. This work is not as industrial as I did in the factory.
I think you have to get these traditional techniques and but with creativity and not just make easy objects to sell to tourists, you know? You see a lot of shops now with handcrafts material, a lot of them from the north of Portugal, in Porto or in Lisbon. But then you walk from a shop to another and you see exactly the same and the same products and not even from the same places. And I think Gour is not on the same bag as these kind of products because we have a little more concept and we are not so commercial, I guess. But I think it's important in a way because in the way of keeping this technique alive, because you are introducing a new contemporary factor to the product. Most of my clients are young consumers, so that didn't have a relation with this technique before. So I think my plan is to go and introduce more techniques and maybe different objects besides rugs and work with more artists and designers. And while this still works, I'll keep on doing it, I guess, you know.
That was Simon Tarek reporting on Gour rug makers in northern Portugal. Still to come on the show, an interview with the Australian photographer Paul Barbera about his latest book, Where They Create, Japan.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Paul Barbera is an Australian photographer whose work takes him all around the world. On his travels, he gets to encounter artists and creatives of all stripes. And this happy circumstance led him to start the project Where They Create. It's a visual documentation of the workspaces of creatives, something that Paul is fascinated by as an interiors photographer. His latest book, Where They Create, Japan, collects his photos of the workspaces of such Japanese creative eminences as Kengo Kuma, Mariko Mori, and Tokujin Yoshioka. It also has a foreword by our very own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Monocle's Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, caught up with Paul while he was in the city.
So, Paul, why did you decide to do a book just about Japan?
Well, this is the second book in a series. The first book actually was a book kind of globally, I guess. It was a book that covered the globe that I'd been working on this project. I guess at that point it was 5 years. So I'd met Frame and decided that they were like, we love the project. We'll turn it into a book. Great. And 5 years have gone past and I'm like ready for a new project to consolidate it into something more than it being, I guess, vaguely about creatives around the world. So with my partner Queenie, who actually helped write the book proposal for this issue, we settled on the idea of countries because I've been pretty obsessed with Japan ever since I first came here 11, 12 years ago or something. So we decided that Queenie's like, well, I think it's a natural fit that you take your energy and love for Japan and we focus, you know, your project, which you're doing anyway. I mean, there's probably of the 32 studios in the book, there's probably maybe three or four that I've already shot from the past that were online, and on my trips I'd always come and seek people out. So very simply, it's the kickoff of a series that if all goes well and this book sells, Frame will commit and we'll do another in maybe another year and let it start being a series based on countries basically. So Japan is the start point, my favorite country.
So what do you love about Japan?
Being constantly confused and lost. I mean, it's less lost now with Google Maps. You can actually get around. Although yesterday I spent an hour and a half on a detour going to the outskirts of Tokyo to shoot a manga artist, but normally that doesn't happen. But it's the constant feeling that you get when you travel, when you get surprised, the surprise of travel. And it just, it is my eighth trip and probably in total, I mean, it's only been about 6 months in total, probably if I add all my trips together, but I'm still mesmerized and confused and just like constantly surprised at things, that little facts that I hear about, and the order in which things are done that is just totally un-Western.
And you've got some really big names in here like Tadao Ando, Kengo Kuma, these famous architects. Was it difficult to get access to these people?
Considering that the Japanese don't necessarily, well, I guess they don't mind press, but it's a little bit more conditional, the press here. So in short, yeah, it was very difficult. And some people took a lot of persistence. And I just had to be very, very strong-willed about the people that I wanted in the book when I made my mind up and try all avenues and all angles. But some people had strange conditions of being part of it. So there's a lot to balance out there in chasing up these people. And of course, I don't want to come in and offend people and be pushy. So that's also difficult to kind of understand how far can you push it. But for the most part, I mean, like surprisingly, some of the bigger names, like Tadao Ando doesn't accept emails, only faxes and handwritten mails. So that was odd because I'm like, okay, I guess I'll fax him. And I sent a fax off, found some website and paid my $2 through PayPal and got my little receipt come through saying, yes, your $2 has been accepted. And I thought, that's it. I'll have to find someone else to really get in contact with them because there's no way that this is really going to work. And 2 weeks later, I got an email. I mean, they reply in email. They don't accept emails. They reply in email saying that Tananda would love to be involved and loves the project. And I'm like, wow. That does work.
Right. The sky's the limit then, you know.
You know, just ask.
Just ask.
Just ask. Yeah. It's amazing, actually.
Yeah. And did you find any of the places that you went to, did they surprise you? You were talking about being surprised earlier. Were there some places you thought, I wouldn't have imagined this person would be working in a place like this?
Yeah, we did. And yes and no. I mean, sometimes someone is, you know, you have a perception that they're smaller than their space is, or the reverse, or their studio is going to be total chaos and it's total order, or the reverse. And I think you can never really predict that. And it doesn't seem to like change very much across countries either. I mean, I feel like what I experienced here, I mean, funny enough, Tyler actually was kind enough to write a foreword and he talks about how surprisingly small all the spaces are. And that people work very independently. And it's true. You're very surprised that these sort of like shared co-working, sprawling, warehouse converted, outskirt spaces of London, of everywhere in Australia, Amsterdam, don't exist really here. I've not seen them. If they do, I haven't seen them. I mean, Kohenauer is in an old sandwich factory, but he's on the outskirts. So that it does exist, and I was definitely surprised because that was the opposite to everything else I'd experienced, which was tiny, and his space was just huge and multi-level, but that's rare.
Do you think, I mean, you're trying to reveal something about people, someone's personality, or it's just, look, this is just a snapshot, this is how they are?
I mean, I think that comes through whether I like it or not. I mean, I'm always looking for kooky little details that reveal. I don't know. I mean, I think it's up to the viewers to make that judgment on what is being revealed. But, I mean, it's still romanticized and curated. It's still a perspective. It's not like – it's raw in that most – I request it, whether they do or not, I don't know. Don't clean up. I really ask specifically, please leave it as it is. I'll find the peace and order. I've been asked this question a lot and thought about it a lot, the link between their work and the space. And I don't know if there's any – I don't know. I can't really draw any massive conclusions between those two things. I think people's work output and people's workspaces are infinitely different.
Right.
And all combinations.
Yeah, there's hope for messy people everywhere.
There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of hope for messy people.
And did you feel a sense of, I suppose, privilege in a way? I mean,
immense.
That you're seeing these spaces that most
immense.
People would never see.
I mean, it's beyond a sense of privilege. I feel like it's – I want to do justice to everyone's spaces. So it's a huge pressure, actually. I mean, yes, I'm pretty quick and it's very casual and – but, you know, people give up their time. They let me into their space. And in some ways, it's, you know, it's a little archive. I'm up to about 300 spaces around the world now. And I think one day there'll be people in there that aren't around or that will be interesting to see what their space looked like. And it's an amazing archive. And I don't know, I feel incredibly privileged. I feel like I want to do it justice. And it's, yeah, I mean, I'm relaxed and it's not like I'm nervously walking through, but it is a lot of pressure to make sure that I'm capturing it all. And I shoot a lot for that reason, you know, to make sure I'm getting it all and seeing, capturing everything I want to put down on film.
Photographer Paul Barbera there speaking to Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson, and his book, Where They Create Japan, is available now from Frame Publishers. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you get a chance. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.